Lördagsgästen på Retro FM.
Lördag förmiddag, då var det dags för lördagsgästen, eller lördagsgästerna får väl ta och säga idag, för de är två stycken till antalet och vi ska börja med den ene. Det är ju så att i dagarna så invigs den prisbelönta utställningen om Auschwitz på Malmömässan i Malmö. Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away. Och med mig i studion mannen som gjorde det hela lite möjligt tillsammans med lite andra människor, Dr. Michael Barenbaum från USA. Dr. Michael Barenbaum, tell me the story about Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away.
The background is quite remarkable. There is a Spanish firm that develops special exhibitions. The leader of the Spanish firm lost his brother. His brother died. And one of the books that he found enormously consoling was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And he said to himself, I'm a museum person. Let me go to Auschwitz and see if they will allow me to do an exhibition on Auschwitz. He goes to Auschwitz, and Auschwitz, remarkably, the State Museum at Auschwitz, remarkably says to him, let's talk about it. And the reason they say let's talk about it is because they are now interested in not only reaching the audience that comes to Auschwitz, yeah, but reaching the people who don't come to Auschwitz. So he came to an agreement with them that they would let him have a range of artifacts to create the exhibition. He turned to a colleague of mine by the name of Professor Robert Jan van Pelt, who, and I say this as a man who wrote an 832-page book with 400 pages of footnotes on Auschwitz. Robert Jan van Pelt knows more about Auschwitz than anyone else. And I would say, without modesty, including me. Once Robert Jan van Pelt was approached, he said, why don't you bring in Michael Barenbaum, because he knows museums. And together we worked with a team in St. Sebastian, Spain, and we created the exhibition. We had three tremendous advantages. Number one, we had the choice of artifacts from Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And with artifacts, you can tell an incredible story. Whatever Auschwitz didn't have, we were able to borrow or to acquire. And then we had all of the testimonies. I had been president of the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation, so we had access to 52,000 testimonies, many of whom by people who were in Auschwitz. We knew how to put together an exhibition. And then the only question is, where does it go? We started in Madrid, and Madrid, remarkably enough, has no connection whatsoever to the Holocaust. The Spanish were so tired from the Spanish Civil War, yeah, that in essence they didn't have the strength to join the Nazis. Not that they wouldn't want to have wanted to, they didn't have the strength to join the Nazis at that point. And something quite remarkable happened, which is we ran the exhibition. What I like to do after I create the exhibition is to run a series of focus groups. So we ran focus groups with them, and everybody got what we wanted them to get. And we even ran a focus group with younger people, 12, 13, 14, and they were all getting it. So we knew something had happened. 600,000 people came to see it in Madrid. We then moved to New York, and New York dismantled the entire exhibition of the Museum of Jewish Heritage, put it in the museum, and New York drew four times as many people as they had ever drawn until Mr. COVID came.
Mm-hmm.
And with Mr. COVID came, they started making appointments to see the exhibition. We then were committed to Kansas City. Kansas City is in the middle of the United States. And Kansas City was sold out for 7 months. And now we have to come back. We came back to Malmo. Mm. One of our requirements by law with the European Union was to bring the artifacts back to Europe. So they had to touch European soil before we could bring them.
Why the choice of Malmö for the next place in the exhibition?
Malmö has an incredible story to tell during the Holocaust. It is the place which received Danish refugees, received them with hospitality and with graciousness. And every Holocaust survivor from Denmark who came to Malmö remembers this place and this city with gratitude and with appreciation. and respect for its citizens. And the other thing is that you can see from Malmo, I don't have to tell you, you're here. You can see from Malmo, Copenhagen, the distance between freedom, between death and freedom is literally visible from this place. And the other reason we came to Malmo was because the city fathers and mothers are worried about the character of the city and want to teach tolerance, pluralism, and mutual acceptance, and want to come out against anti-Semitism. And they chose something very bold, which is to invite us to bring the exhibition here to precisely lance the boil. Not accept it, but challenge it.
Och den andra lördagsgästen också i studion idag, det är Catherine Hauptmann som är chef för det nya Svenska Förintelsemuseet som kommer att slå upp portarna inom de närmsta åren. Och vi tar lite på engelska här, jag och Catherine, för att Michael ska kunna hänga med där. Catherine, you and I visited the exhibition Auschwitz not far away, not long ago, at Malmömässan just the other day. What was your impression of the exhibition?
So I'm very touched by the exhibition. I actually saw it in New York as well, so I'm a little bit familiar with it. But I think what touched me the most is that it's so obvious, this with the objects that are recycled, all from the, you know, from the uniforms to the objects at the same time when people died and were murdered. So it's beyond imagination what that means. That's really obvious in this exhibition.
And still, it's unimaginable why people out there today, revisionists tell that this never happened. I mean, there's so many evidence, and the Germans being so thorough, they were documenting about everything.
Well, I'm really less worried today about the revisionists, the Holocaust deniers, because let's face it, the Germans documented what they did. They took pictures of it. They wrote it down. They bragged about it. And they compiled enormous records. And their victims also engaged in what we call polemical resistance. And one of the elements of polemical resistance was to write it down, to record. The great Jewish historian Simon Dubnow, before he died, said, "Schreibt und verschreibt," write and record, and tell the story. So people clandestinely made photographs, people made documentation. People who were artists drew, and we have pictures in there of artists who gave you visual testimony. And we also, in the Shoah Foundation, created 52,000 testimonies, video testimonies of a couple of hours apiece telling the story. We have to worry today about not wholesale revisionism, but trivialization, vulgarization, misrepresentation. We see it at the risk of being political. We see it in the war.
Yeah.
The idea that Mr. Putin believes he's fighting the Nazis.
You mean the special operation?
Well, remember, language is a way of camouflaging.
Yeah.
Camouflaging what you do. The Germans used the idea of final solution to the Jewish problem, the Endlösung. So they used the word executive measures.
Mm-hmm.
They spoke about, they didn't speak about murder and killing. They used even the word Kristallnacht for the November pogroms. Yeah. Crystal is beautiful, it's fragile. And here they burn synagogues and loot businesses and arrest 30,000 men, and it's Kristallnacht. So we're worried about trivialization. In the United States, we have people who said the masks were yellow stars. The vaccine, you have a...
The anti-vaxxers, the anti-vaxxers hijacked the symbol.
Hijacked the thing, vaccines make us... make you safe with the gates of Auschwitz.
No.
So we're worried about trivialization, vulgarization. And one more thing we're also worried about right now is there are those who are angry that the Germans didn't complete the job. So you have a sweatshirt on the internet called 6MWE. 6 million wasn't enough. You had somebody on January 6th, 2021 with the sign Auschwitz staff member, as if one would... Mm. walk into a nation's capital imagining oneself to be an Auschwitz staff member, the lowest form of humanity you can imagine, and almost saying we didn't do enough. So that's our problem today. And our problem today, therefore, is we must tell the story. And we must also really teach it in a context where so much is arguing against the truth and the importance of this truth.
Catherine, I know that on a personal level, you are very close to the Holocaust and the Holocaust survivors. Your grandfather being a Holocaust survivor from former Soviet Union, what's Ukraine today? Can you tell the story?
So I first learned about what happened to my grandfather. I was raised with my grandfather. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was also the eyewitness to all of his family. He had four sisters and they had several children and all his neighbors and so on. They were all killed in a massacre. And he was one of the very few survivors from that. And when I was a child and grew up, he was the witness in a trial against the person that the perpetrator. And so, and that's when he started to talk about this history. He never talked about it before. And I was about 7 years old when I learned about this. And already then I knew that someday I need to work with this. This is really, really important for the world to remember.
Catherine, you're the director of the new Swedish Holocaust Museum. You actually started your job just the other month. How far are you on the project? When will it open?
Oh, we're going to open in June.
You are?
We're going to open with the digital activities in June. And we're actually cooperating with the UC Shoah Foundation with the testimonies, because there are of the 52 or 55,000 that they have collected, there are about 300 that are in Swedish and are actually recorded here in Sweden. So it's survivors that came to Sweden after the Holocaust. So we have a material to start with. There has, during all last year, we have together with the Living History Forum in Sweden, have started to collect different objects and documents and photographs from survivor families. And we are starting with different digital activities in June. So that's the first step. In September, we will have our own space in the museum. It's in Stockholm, central in Stockholm. It would be an exhibition space. And the first exhibition on site will be in a year. And in the first 5 years, we will only have temporary exhibitions. And during that time, we are searching for a permanent location, which will be a bigger venue. Okay. So that's briefly the plan.
Dr. Barenbaum, Michael, you were born right after World War II in Newark, New Jersey, in a Jewish family. How come you end up spending your entire adult life trying people to remember what happened during those terrible, horrible years during the Holocaust?
I grew up, I was born after the war, and I grew up in Hebrew-speaking Jewish day schools. And my teachers were either Holocaust survivors or refugees, but we didn't use the term. We were the generation of whipped cream and ice cream that was to make up for a world that was lost. I also grew up in a particular synagogue. We were religious Jews. I grew up in a synagogue that was comprised of German and Belgian Jews who had been in the diamond business and therefore escaped with some of their possessions. Because if you had buildings or if you had a manufacturing, you couldn't escape with anything. And they were trying to recreate in the United States what they had left behind in Frankfurt or in Antwerp or in Brussels. And therefore, the Holocaust surrounded me, but we never spoke about it. I was working on a question in history Why did the Jews not go out of business after they were defeated? Why, as an ancient people, did we reinvent ourselves after defeat and take Jewish life forward after decimating defeats in the year 586, in the year 70, in the year 135, etc.? Somebody said, you know, Michael, you're not asking an ancient question, you're asking the modern question. I said, look, I'm an ancient historian. What the hell do I need to know this modern stuff? He said, why don't you start reading? And he gave me reading material, and I started reading. And I realized that subliminally I was asking, subconsciously, I was asking the question of my generation. Hmm. Now, if you take my career forward, then I would say, and this is luck, accident, maybe a little bit of talent, but fortune and opportunity. I did two things in my career. I told the story that could not be told to me, to the American people, and now to other people in different museums throughout the world. I put it into words, images, thoughts, testimonies, and the like, in a way that I could never learn it as a child. And then I had the opportunity to give the people who couldn't tell me what was happening the opportunity to tell their testimony to the world. And now we have this additional material to be able to tell the story. Let me tell one story that gives you an idea of how much it permeated my youth without my knowing it. My parents were Americans. They had my grandparents had been immigrants to the United States. My parents, their major thing was how to become American but also traditional and how to fit into the society. I wanted to go to summer camp, and I wanted my best friend to go to summer camp with me. So my best friend, who unbeknownst to me spoke to Yiddish, he spoke Yiddish to his parents, says, Michael wants me to go to lager. Lager was the word for camp, but lager for his parents meant concentration camp.
Casey. Yeah.
His father calls up my father, furious, angry, screaming, you're not taking my kid to lager. So my father gradually grasps why the anger, and he says, let's go for a ride on a Sunday morning. We'll go up to the camp. The camp had a swimming pool. The camp had tennis courts. The camp had a lake. The camp had canoes. The camp had bunks, which were relatively, you know, were nice, and they weren't luxurious, but they were fully adequate for 13 or 12-year-old boys. And the father turns to his son, screams at him. He said, don't you understand what lager is? So we were struck by, surrounded by that, but not knowing it and not being able to put it into words. And then I was able to do it in words. So I've done a couple of things in my life. I'm by training an academic, and I had a very great piece of luck, which is I was in charge of the staff that oversaw the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. But I didn't know anything about museums, but they had five previous directors before I came in who knew museums but didn't know the Holocaust. And somebody said, you know, after you have five bad marriages, it can't be all her fault. You have to be fair. Yeah, yeah. It can't be all her fault. 90% her fault always, but it can't all be her fault. So they said, let's choose somebody who knows the Holocaust and may be smart enough to learn museums. So they accidentally chose me, and I was able enough to learn museum language. And the other thing that happened, which is a historic occurrence, which is that, and we have to remember back, the VCR was invented. The VCR meant that all of a sudden you could film Holocaust survivors inexpensively. It didn't have to be film. It didn't need a professional camera. It didn't need a professional studio. So we got all of this additional material that was never available to a previous generation. Give you one historic example. There are only 36 audio histories of people who were actually slaves in the United States. And we probably have, between the Shoah Foundation and Yale's Fortune of Archives, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Yad Vashem, we probably have in excess of 80,000 visual testimonies of people who went through the camps. Now, let me give your listeners an example. This is no longer elite history. It's not the history written by scholars or by poets or by professional historians, people who keep written records all the way through. This is from Joe the baker and Chava the housemaker and Shlomo who was a cobbler and somebody else who ran a factory, by a mechanic, by a scholar, by a poet, by everybody. It is the most earth-shaking history of normal people, and you get access to every sort of experience, which gives us a brand new language in order to create. And the most interesting thing, it makes the history come alive. And then I turn to the contemporary world, which is sadly, the Holocaust is one of the few events, the further away we come from the Holocaust, the larger its importance looms. It echoes. Not parallels, not equivalents, but it echoes. And it echoes again and again and again. And, you know, I had a dream that someday I could be irrelevant. I'd love to say this is 20th century history. We 20th century men and women could not do anything like this. We learned and we put this behind. And yet you have war crimes, you have racial crimes,
yeah.
You have anti-Semitism flourishing in the world. So sadly, I will not die irrelevant. I'd rather die irrelevant and leave a good world to my children and grandchildren than live relevant and leave a lousy world to my children and grandchildren. So we fight to teach the past because we believe that we have to transform the future.
Back to you, Catherine, growing up with your grandfather, a Holocaust survivor. When did you understand what the Holocaust was all about growing up and the experiences your grandfather must have had?
Question. It's really still kind of hard to talk about that,
yeah.
The personal things. But I think I at that time, I had never heard anything like it, so I thought it was, you know, this is a really strange thing that my grandfather experienced, and I couldn't understand why this happened to my family. Why would someone want to do that?
It's like a bad horror story?
Yeah, like a bad horror story, and I saw these pictures in my head about, you know, what they looked like, how they, you know, their hiding place, different things, so I kind of imagined how it was. And, you know, because my grandfather, sometimes he had some memories that he didn't
want to share.
He didn't want to share, but for example, this was, you know, I grew up in the 70s, everyone wore clogs.
Yeah.
Treskor.
Yeah.
And he got like panic attacks from that sound, for example, and I couldn't understand. I thought maybe he didn't like children, but that was, you know,
the sound
that
of...
was not it. Yeah, how it's, you know, when the children were running with clogs, for example, because everyone wore them. And he was very specific with the, you know, how important it is with the close people, to love each other, to cherish what we have. But at the same time, he had his, you know, his experiences, of course, which affected his life, how he, you know, what he did. But he, you know, he stayed in Poland after the war. So he came to Sweden in 1968, and this was the there was this huge anti-Semitic campaign in Poland at that time. So many survivors from Poland, many Jews from Poland, came to Sweden around that time. And when he came to Sweden, this was the first time in his life that he could kind of reconnect with his Jewishness, the traditions, his memories, and so on. So it became a completely new life for him.
We're coming to a close in this interview, and we're going to round up about the Auschwitz exhibition at Malmö Mässan not long ago, not far away. Michael, we talk about the stories and a tremendous amount of stories about the terrible, terrible things that happened in Auschwitz and other concentration camps and to Jews around Europe at this time. But in order to survive, there must be some... Bring us a bright story, if there are any, that you have collected during the years.
You need, in order to survive, you need something that keeps you alive.
Yeah.
For some, it was human solidarity. Human solidarity. I just did the introduction to a survivor's memoir, and he gave the whole thing in one sentence. He said, I learned to trust Ernesto, my best friend. I trusted him completely. And to this day, I thank God that things did not reach so bad that I had to steal his shoes.
Wow.
That tells you about human solidarity, and it tells you about human desperation.
Yeah.
Let me tell one more story with... I had a teacher who had a tattoo, and in those days, if they wore tattoos, they were embarrassed, so they wore long sleeves. But we were religious Jews, so you have to put on tefillin, you have to put on your phylacteries in the morning, which means you must lift up your arm. And he had numbers on his arm, and we didn't understand numbers. And there were only two reasons we would write numbers on our arms. One is that... We finally worked up the courage to ask a girl out for a date, and we didn't have a piece of paper to write her telephone number, so we write a telephone number on our arms so we could ask her out. And you were embarrassed. You should have had a piece of paper, but you finally got up the courage. The second reason is if you were going to cheat on an exam.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, he wasn't going to cheat on an exam. And to the best of our knowledge, he was married, and therefore he wasn't asking girls out on dates. So we didn't understand why he had a tattoo. Only later did we understand what the nature of the tattoo was.
Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away. The exhibition open right now at Malmö Mässan in Malmö for a couple of months. Dr. Michael Berenbaum and Catherine Hauptmann, director of the Swedish Holocaust Museum, thanks for sharing and thanks for telling your stories.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us. Lördagsgästen på Retro FM.